The story of Kansas City jazz is one we tell often, with good reason. In the 1930s, this was a place where talent and history converged, resulting in a whole new sound that aficionados continue to study today. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we're going to think about how our city's jazz history informs the present day. Who's pushing the envelope in 2014, and where's the jazz audience? Do tourists flock to clubs here in town like they do in New York and New Orleans? Copenhagen just put on a huge festival to honor a guy by the name of Ben Webster. He was from Kansas City until he went on a European tour and never came home. We'll get his story too after this news. That's Charlie Parker, the saxophonist whose name has become synonymous with Kansas City jazz. But wait, who's this? This is Parker's contemporary, the lesser-known Ben Webster. Lesser-known around here, anyway. Anita Dixon, executive director of the Mutual Musicians Foundation, just got back from Denmark, where Ben Webster is a legend. The Kansas City saxophonist lived out the last years of his life in Copenhagen. As a result, jazz lovers in that city feel a connection to the Kansas City story that we living here know little about. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard is about Kansas City's jazz legacy and how we relate to it today. Is our jazz history a fossil to be preserved? Is it a baseball team to be cheered on from the sidelines? Is it something more abstract, like a spirit of originality and authenticity that can be translated to present-day movements in music and art across genres? We'll get to that later on. For now, let's turn to the story of Ben Webster. It's my pleasure to welcome Anita Dixon to the studio. Hi, Anita.
Thank you for having me back.
How was your trip to Copenhagen?
Incredible. Incredible. If there are more words for incredible, then go ahead and insert them.
Okay. We'll pull out the thesaurus later. Tell us the story of Ben Webster.
Ben Webster, Kansas City native, born off of 24th Street. He was born within the 3 square miles of segregation within Kansas City history in 1909. An incredible saxophone player, but started off as a piano player, actually. Piano player in the silent movies and things that were part of Kansas City history, and progressed into becoming this incredible saxophone player, and actually Charlie Parker's contemporary, as you said. You know, many believe that he was as good as Parker, you know, and in Europe he was considered to be that person that they love. So in that whole thing, it's, you know, I would love to get into more of that, but the importance of the things that he did, you know, as part of Duke Ellington's band and the history of who he was as he went to Copenhagen and the things that happened, you know, as a result of him staying is even more incredible than I can say.
He was about 10 years older than Charlie Parker and was one of the musicians Charlie Parker famously heard in his school skipping, making up his own music curriculum in the club's days.
Exactly.
What do you know about that relationship?
I don't know as much as I probably should. I got into understanding that as part of the foundation, you understand that this was a testing ground, a school of sorts, you know, the cutting contest, the, you know, jam sessions and various things like that. And to hear someone like Ben Webster, he played in Andy Kirk's band temporarily. He did a lot of things. You know, if you're a kid like Charlie Parker and your whole mind is your music, and you run into somebody like Ben Webster knowing the history of that, this is the person that you follow. This is the person that you listen to.
Why did he move to Denmark?
It was an opportunity. You know, actually, he didn't fly, but there was a situation when he was playing with the Ellington band, and everyone knew him to be a heavy, heavy sleeper. And if you woke him, he was a prize fighter at one time, you know, and if you woke him, he'd come up swinging. Well, he was on the plane with Ellington and some group members, and they were all asleep, and the pilot came out and said, you know, we're getting ready. Lenny shook Ben Webster, and Ben Webster slugged the guy, and the guy went out.
Whoa.
Okay. And the guy went out. And the plane, you know, is doing what it does. And they had to shake him up and, you know, get him up and put him back in front of the controls before they
died. My gosh.
And so Ellington told him, look, you're a liability.
On an airplane.
To this thing, so we can't. And as a result of that, he took one his only voyage to Copenhagen and remained.
Was there something about that scene there that drew him that compared to Kansas City maybe in a favorable way? Or was it just that he felt a connection that was not a comparative kind
of
connection?
You know, if you look at this thing historically, for many black musicians, many African Americans and people from America found a kinship in Europe and the other countries that they did not find other places. Segregation was the rule of the day in America, or was not in Europe. And from the stories that I hear, particularly the gentleman that was my host, Henrik Iverson, who was with Ben Webster from the beginning, married to a black woman from America himself, you know, and seeing those things in the favorable light of being in Europe, I experienced this myself, so I can see.
Even today, you experience
absolutely.
This. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Charlie absolutely. Parker is, as we've said, synonymous with Kansas City jazz and its golden age. He's buried here. Musicians perform in the cemetery to honor him. Does the story of Ben Webster, someone who didn't stay here, who's not buried here, does his story lend a kind of complexity to our understanding of Kansas City jazz that we need to think about?
I'd have to say that, because what he experienced in Copenhagen has to be something that if you're a musician, particularly if you're a black musician in America, these are the things that you need to decide about how your career is going to be. What is your career going to be? Is it going to be totally commercial? Is it going to be something that are you going to get the work? Or are you going to? What are the things that you're going to face? And he decided that the people that he met and the situation that he met, and the acceptance of himself as a black man, acceptance of himself as a musician, and everything was much, much more important.
Well, I found a clip online of Ben Webster playing Over the Rainbow, which, given its association with The Wizard of Oz and leaving Kansas, I thought it might be a poignant selection. So let's listen to it now.
Please.
Hear that. What are the qualities you hear, just having been traveling around with the Ben Webster Foundation, hearing what people have to say about him?
That his blues quality, his improvisational knowledge of who he was as a musician, particularly bringing that Kansas City thing, was unequaled. He understood the blues. He understood what it meant to the genre of jazz and how to play that thing to move you. And the guy was telling me, the guy being Iverson, was telling me how people would be in this jazz house that we went to and would be transfixed by this music, but you can see why. You know, the tonality, the passion in just something that is such a everyday tune to us and has been sung in so many different ways, that when you hear Ben Webster do it, you can see why Charlie Parker might have wanted to emulate who he was.
How did you hook up with the jazz community in Copenhagen to begin with?
Amazing. Synchronicity. We were working with the Historic Kansas City Foundation, of which I'm a member. And Jake Wagner, who was the president, got a grant, you know, a rocket grant from there to do some international work for preservation. And we hooked up with Henrik on a Skype. And the conversation began then, because the first thing they asked me when they came in the door is, do you know who Ben Webster is? And I was like, give me a break, really? Yeah, I know who Ben Webster is. Look on my wall, you know. And we got to talking, and I find out that this Henrik Iverson, Wolfsgaard Iverson, is the founder and chairman of a 40-year-old organization from Ben Webster. They were very, very, very good friends.
And they throw, there's a prize given in his honor every year.
Yes.
There are parties thrown. When it would have been his 100th birthday in 2009, there mm-hmm. was a huge celebration, some lesser celebrations for his 105th recently, but still mm-hmm. like 300 people in attendance. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of the audience for Ben Webster and their understanding of Kansas City, his Kansas City roots?
Well, you know, when I got to Copenhagen, one of the first things that was done is there was a big band night in my honor. You know, so I go to this club and they're like, oh,
Big Shot,
Anita Dixon's here. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's me. And, you know, all these dedications and things. There is a huge acceptance of the Kansas City style of who can, you know, it's like I was Dorothy in Oz, you know, look who's here. Yeah. And so the acceptance of Kansas City, the style of the music is heavily studied. 200 people showed up at an event that they did the next night. You know, just the study of music, the study of the Kansas City style and jazz was unequaled. I have never seen that type of intellectual and then entertainment all together.
Is there a difference in how they relate to our jazz history from how we relate to our jazz history? Like, is there a different perspective that they bring to it? Or
I'd have to say that different perspective is the fact, and I have to say fact, that they accept the music as an African of the diaspora creation. And that is something that we constantly have some type of debate on in America.
Flesh that out a little
more. Well, to say that, I met a gentleman named Ole Matheson that has done this incredible book on African tones, tonality, the history of jazz as it pertains to the African American in America, the enslavement period, and all those various things. And this is something that I find, you know, like heavily debated in America. And this is nothing that's ever debated in Copenhagen. This is an acceptance and a reverence for that situation.
What did you learn from your time there that you think you'll take forward in your work here in Kansas City with the Mutual Musicians Foundation?
Virtually what I learned is that there is opportunity. There is no fighting amongst musicians. The average gig is $350. They still have an active union. And I think that those things should be a part of when. And so as we move into our centennial on the 2017, that's what we will be concentrating on, taking care of each other.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about how Kansas City does and maybe doesn't relate to its profound jazz identity. We hope you'll weigh in too. 816-235-2888. More in a moment. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard is back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with a crew that can tell us about Kansas City's jazz history and jazz identity, because it really is part of how we think of ourselves and our story. But how does that relationship between past and present play out, not just in our minds, but in our communities, in our nightclubs, in our alleyways, perhaps on our iPods? With me now for that discussion is Bill Brownlee, who writes about jazz on the blog Plastic Sax, where he also keeps an extensive weekly jazz calendar. Hi, Bill.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. The story of how your blog got its name might be instructive for us as we launch into this conversation. So why do you call your blog Plastic Sax?
Well, several years ago, the American Jazz Museum, which is one of the great assets here in Kansas City, acquired the Grafton saxophone that was once played by Charlie Parker at the Massey Hall concert in Toronto. The museum acquired the saxophone for over $100,000, and it's there on display in the American Jazz Museum at this very moment. Well, just as a contrarian by nature, I thought, well, why don't I create my own why don't I contribute to Kansas City's jazz scene by creating a blog to document what's happening here from my own perspective, and inspired in part by that six-figure purchase I called my blog Plastic Sex.
So your blog has gotten a lot of traction since then, and you have a pretty dedicated following. So I want to start by asking you this question. How well do you think we capitalize on our jazz history here in Kansas City, and is capitalizing on it the purpose?
There's, for the enthusiasts, and there are plenty in this room and elsewhere, you know, we have the Jazz Museum, we have two fully committed jazz bloggers, we have a jazz magazine, we have all these clubs, but we, none of that has translated completely into, you know, a full, rich, vibrant audience. On Sunday, I attended two music events in Kansas City, one at the Power and Light District, an R&B show that drew 9,000 people. After that concert ended, I walked three blocks away to a jazz club where there were more musicians performing than there were people in the audience listening.
If you, around Kansas City, you really don't hear people saying that they don't care about jazz. So why isn't there an audience, or is there more, is there a theoretical audience?
We are all good at giving the scene lip service, I think, and you won't find a marketing brochure that doesn't mention Kansas City's jazz legacy, but that's different than actually going out and truly enjoying live jazz in any number of Kansas City jazz venues.
I'm also joined by Steve Paul. He's was recently arts editor for the Kansas City Star, but and he's a fixture in the Kansas City jazz scene. But he now heads up the Star's editorial board. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me here.
So what are your thoughts on what Bill Brownlee just had to say?
Well, you know, jazz in general, you know, has never been a widely popular, you know, except maybe you could argue in the swing era it crossed, became America's popular music for a while. But jazz and the jazz that we're talking about, whether it's Charlie Parker or Ben Webster, it spoke to, you know, a certain audience, hipster audience, intellectuals, people who like to have a good time, like to, you know, I'd like to partake of entertainment in.
So when you say it wasn't popular, you mean like
I mean,
not
it was not
mainstream.
Widely. It was not widely popular. It's not wide, you know, acceptance of it. You know, especially when we, you know, for the last half century or so, jazz became quite difficult. Let's say in the '60s, and if you look at numbers of, you know, it's not a good guide anymore. But if you look at the percentage of, you know, CD sales or that kind of thing. Jazz is a very small slice, small slice of the music industry. But, you know, but jazz has always had an avid audience. And in Kansas City, we, you know, our jazz history here is phenomenal. You know, we were one of the three or four major centers of the development of modern jazz, but also just kind of the thing that made our culture. But that was a long time ago.
Well, Steve, we heard a little bit from Anita Dixon about how Kansas City's relationship to this history compares with the scene in Denmark. You've traveled several times to Havana and done some writing about those experiences. To say that Cuba truly capitalizes on something is a complicated assertion, given its communist political and economic structure. But nonetheless, how would you say Havana capitalizes on its jazz history and its reputation for great music? Any comparison to be made with Kansas City?
Yes and no. It's an odd comparison. I mean, the thing about Havana is that music is largely performed for tourists. But the other thing about Havana that Kansas City could actually, you know, emulate is that you can't go anywhere without hearing music. I mean, there are musicians on the street. There are musicians in restaurants. There are musicians at clubs. There aren't a lot of jazz clubs, you know, but everywhere you go, you hear music. And it's not always jazz per se, but, I mean, you will hear, just wandering around, Guantanamera, a half a dozen times a day.
But that thing that Bill Brownlee just mentioned about there being maybe at times more musicians than audience for jazz in Kansas City, why aren't we hearing music coming out of every doorway?
Why not? Open the doors and open the windows and put a band there. It's possible. If we really want to, if we really want to exploit our history and celebrate our history, then it needs to be done everywhere.
Well, Lori Chandler is here, too. She runs a jazz club called Take Five that's in the process of moving from Stillwell, Kansas, to Overland Park. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
When did you open Take Five?
We opened in January of 2010.
The location's venue has been really intriguing to me. Stillwell, Kansas is kind of out there where the suburbs start to meet something more rural. I mean, it's a good 45 minutes from the city center, where the part of the city really known for jazz. Talk to me a little bit about that location.
Well, part of the reason we opened there is because it was a facility that was already finished out. So it was very easy for me to get in and open the doors. And frankly, when we opened, we weren't looking to be a jazz club. We were a coffee shop that hosted occasional live music. So the jazz development was a happy accident at first and then very purposeful after that.
Was the happy accident audience driven? I'm curious about whether Stillwell is a place where there is a jazz audience.
Well, and it's technically within the far south reaches of Leawood.
Oh,
but
okay.
It does feel halfway to Wichita, and people have joked about that. But we started by hosting a fundraiser for a trio named Diverse, which is Ryan Lee, Ben Leifer, and Herman Mahari. I didn't know them. I hadn't heard their music, but I said, okay, sure, let's do this. And I think we had 10 to 15 people, but I was blown away by what they did. And it sounded great in the room. And I think one of the issues, Steve mentioned not everybody is putting a band in and throwing the windows open. It's not something you can do once or twice and say, oh, it doesn't work, we're stopping. You have to keep at it. You're not going to make money hosting bands the first week, unless you're the Sprint Center and it's Miley Cyrus, but we're not doing that, right? So you have to be persistent. You have to keep after it, and your audience will come to you.
Anita Dixon, I want to get you to weigh in on this, because now we're talking about where jazz is moving around the city, where the audience is moving around the city. What are your insights on that from the perspective of the American Jazz Museum? The Mutual Musicians Foundation.
I hear this so often, and I hear it, but the contrast between the audience in Copenhagen and the audience in America, and I have to say America because this is just not our problem. This is all over America. Why doesn't jazz, quote unquote, sell? Okay. You've got... At Take Five, where the musicians go, people follow. Simple as that. The more popular the musician, the more popular the group, they go where they go. What I saw in the contrast is that jazz as an art form is considered to be an art form to be protected and supported in Copenhagen. So it is heavily supported by Parliament, is heavily supported by arts groups. When they have a jazz festival, 150,000 people show up. It's 10 days, so they have an idea that jazz is an art form. Jazz is supported. Jazz is given its due. The musicians are treated as laborers. That whole thing that used to be a part of Kansas City's scene. And, I have to say that jazz was hugely popular, in Kansas City at one time. But we're talking about from my experience as a Black person. I can remember being as young as 4 years old and watching my parents getting dressed for a dance or something that was down on 18th and Paseo and various things like that. I cannot remember my life without these people in it. And as long as the 60s were going, Thelonious Monk was still alive, and Duke Ellington and Ella, all these incredible people were still alive. So we had this thing, but because the commercialization of jazz became more of a focus for everybody in America. Okay, these people started dying. These big estates started taking over everybody's music and things. So now we've got the estate saying, you can't use this image, you can't do this music, da-da-da-da-da. But in Copenhagen and in European countries, that's not the case. That's not the case.
Something you mentioned really interests me. The idea of jazz as something to be protected. That's an interesting perspective because art forms evolve, they change, they spring up anew. What is the significance of protecting an art form, perhaps even within its originating historic context?
Because without the historic context, without the authenticity of its origins, you have dilution. Okay, in anything. So to a trained ear, to hear someone who is an imitator of a Ben Webster or something like that, you can tell if their heart and their soul is in it. Teaching improvisation, teaching the methods of jazz, preserving that information is some of the most important things anyone will ever do. And some of the best technicians of that I heard in Europe. In Kansas City, I don't see that as much as I did there.
A couple things on that. One, I think Bill was at this show the other night. I mean, you have institutions that kind of protect jazz in certain kinds of ways. And let's be clear, there are different kinds of jazz. Preservation Hall Jazz Band was in town over the weekend, and that's an institution, and it's certainly changed from what it once was, and they play a certain style of music. But it preserves it's kind of a preservation project, of course. You have some small gestures, the NEA Jazz Masters, for example, which is, pretty small compared to what Anita's talking about in terms of, Copenhagen. But there are a few things that try to preserve jazz and jazz history. Beyond that, it is a tough sell. I would talk about the Mutual Musicians Foundation. There's some exciting things happening in Kansas City. I'm trying to remember a night that was 5, 6, 7 years ago when I first heard a young trumpet player named Herman Mahari. Didn't know him, hadn't heard of him, heard him for the first time, late one night at the foundation, and I was just sort of blown away. Here's the future of jazz. I mean, there were kids at the time coming out of the UMKC jazz program, for example, that began to make me feel like there was a future for jazz in Kansas City. And I
can agree with you there to a certain extent. That being that there is not any opportunity beyond the conservatory methods. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have young musicians that can't afford to go to college, can't afford that experience. And because they can't afford that experience, they find themselves in a situation where those who are quote unquote conservatorily trained, won't let them in. Won't let them into this jazz scene because they're not considered to be intellectual enough or they've not had the quote-unquote current training. And we're finding that so much that we have branched off into finding those middle class, people who cannot afford that experience and giving them that opportunity, giving them that laborer opportunity to the extent.
What do you mean by giving them that opportunity?
Giving them that opportunity. There used to be a time in jazz and music history where if you were a middle class, not able to afford college person and you wanted to be a musician, there was the foundation. There was Local 627. There was a journeyman thought that you could go from club to club and club and club like these people like Ben Webster and them did and learn this craft, learn this music. Now it is such to the point where if you're not coming out of these highly expensive situations, you cannot get in.
Mm-hmm. Bill Brownlee, you were just listening to a discussion about Herman Mahari and some of his projects. And Steve Paul was suggesting that maybe that's the future of jazz. We're hearing some other arguments as well. What do you think?
Well, the reason I may have sounded frustrated earlier is because Kansas City is in the midst of this artistic renaissance in jazz. There are all these wonderful musicians, wherever they came from. There are the UMKC kids, and there are now people moving here, musicians moving here from out of town to set up camp here to play with these other great musicians.
Any names you'd like to throw out there?
For instance, Matt Otto moved here from California. Peter Schlamm moved here from St. Louis. Both are incredibly forward-thinking, talented musicians. So the time has never been better, at least in the last 25 years, I don't think, for the music. But the audience has yet to catch up.
Well, what do you think out there? How does Kansas City relate to its jazz history and identity? Is it a deep, authentic, relevant conversation we're having with this art form? Or do you think we pay lip service? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again, 816-235-2888. So you were just talking about the audience, and if the argument is that there is not the audience for it, and that's up for debate, but if that's the case, what about the resources, the attention that we in theory pay to it? Is there something else we should be paying more attention to, or is there a responsibility to cultivate that audience, given that we are here in Kansas City?
I believe that for it to really be successful, there has to be an organic, natural new groundswell of audience support rather than a top-down type of embrace that, you know, Anita's talking about. I know, you know, Anita's out there doing, you know, the Lord's work every day at the foundation. And so, you know, she does it both ways. But I'd like to, you know, I think for the only way for jazz to experience the type of audience support it needs, it has to be natural. It can't be from exclusively from grants and foundations.
Totally agree.
What about jazz tourism? A lot of cities, well, maybe not a lot of cities, but like New York, New Orleans, there are cities with a jazz history that really people will travel. There are really, they call them jazz heads, and they will travel to hear jazz. Do people come here? I'll direct that first to you, Lori, since you have a venue. Do you get tourists?
Well, if you call people coming from Independence and Liberty out to Leawood tourists,
it's a long way. Yeah.
But part of the problem is this city, to that point specifically, this city is so spread out that trying to get a tourist that's coming to hear jazz out to Leawood, down to the foundation, over to the Blue Room, back out to Broadway. I mean, there's the transportation infrastructure just isn't there to make that happen. And I think that's part of the challenge that we have. But I don't think we're very cohesive about promoting the jazz scene in Kansas City either.
What would that look like for it to be cohesive? What does that mean?
I think there are some organizations working on that. And recently, I think KC Jazz Alive is one of those. But being able to coordinate, like the Charlie Parker celebration that went on, was that a month ago, a couple months ago?
August.
I'm losing track of time these days. But if that had been, that word had been spread out to the people that own the venues that are performing jazz. Like I book 2 to 3 months in advance, and I found out about a week ahead that that celebration was going on, and I was already booked, and it wasn't Charlie Parker centric. So those kinds of opportunities where we can make a lot of noise together on occasion, I think are really important.
Absolutely. Little background, I did the African American Tours and Attractions Company in Kansas City for 27 years. And to say that the lay of the land for jazz is not a cohesive thing, excuse me, in Kansas City. The infrastructure is not set up for that. The various venues and things like that, like you would have problems. But there is also not a focus. And I can't say we've got a new Convention and Visitors Association person. So I'm hoping that this person comes in and is not handcuffed by those who are part of the structure to the current structure. Because the last 27 years has been disastrous. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars that go out for marketing. But when it comes to jazz, it's the obligatory person on the brochure and that's it. You know, it's like, oh, we're jazz. But come and see this and this and this and this and this. But don't get together on this thing.
Now, thinking about some of jazz's underground roots, that there was, you know, the big show in the concert hall and then the jam session at places like the Mutual Musicians Foundation. Is there a difference between jazz for popular consumption and jazz that might be behind closed doors that might not be part of a cohesive marketing infrastructure?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And let me say this. In 2013, I had some experts come to town and discuss this thing, and it was called Jazz Center Stage. We were at the Gym Theater. It was called Jazz Center Stage, The Economics of Audience Development. And we went into trying to understand why the audiences are gone and what to do. And we came up with a four-prong situation: entertainment, tourism, preservation, and tourism.
We are running low on time, and I do want to get callers in on this. So let's turn to Nathan and Lawrence. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Well, I'm enjoying the conversation, but I haven't heard the point made that jazz, you know, has moved from the dance floor to being a museum piece, and that has greatly affected its popularity. And I think that, you know, if we can support jazz as a dance form or as a popular form instead of focusing on it being a museum piece, you know, I think that's a direction that will make it more popular.
I'll respond that, Nathan, that, you know, I don't think that the music that Lori features at her club, you know, sounds like a museum piece, nor does what happens at the foundation late on a Friday or Saturday night sound like a museum piece. You know, that's vital, vibrant, relevant music.
Well,
that was the point that I was actually trying to make earlier when I said, you know, the jazz of the big band era or swing was the dance music of the time. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the jazz is no longer a dance music.
We've got to take a break. I wish we didn't, but this conversation about Kansas City jazz will return. Don't go away. And we're back. Just another minute for this lively conversation here on Central Standard about how we relate to our legendary jazz history. I'm Gina Kaufman in the studio with Steve Paul, Lori Chandler, Anita Dixon, and Bill Brownlee. I want to run by you guys a little bit of a quote from a controversial article in The Atlantic in 2012 about the jazz district authenticity problem. A question was raised, regardless of how you feel about the premise of that article, and that's this. What is the best way to enshrine a place where an art form, especially a living art form like music, evolved? And what is the place's role, if any, in continuing to shape that art form?
thanks. The most important thing the American Jazz Museum does, I'll leave it at this, is, you know, they have the Blue Room, which is a terrific listening room. They have live jazz there, usually four nights a week. And a lot of that music is excellent. That's that museum's contribution to Kansas City, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to celebrate and to have a place that music is played and appreciated and attracts tourists. There are far more tourists who arrive in New York, for example, to listen to jazz. The authenticity problem, I mean, you can go to jazz at Lincoln Center and, their club – the club there doesn't feel authentic at all.
My friends, we are all out of time. We had too much to say, but that means we'll just say it another time. Steve Paul, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Bill Brownlee, great to meet you.
Yes, thank you.
Anita Dixon, a pleasure as always. And Lori Chandler, best luck at Take Five's new location.
Thank you.